Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of today's Football Times, a podcast that looks at stories from the football world from These Football Times. I'm Rob Fletcher and I'll be in the dugout for today's episode and the return of club football at all levels. As always, we've got loads of interesting topics to talk about, evaluate before looking into the week ahead in football. I'm joined by David and the Dave, which will make things really straightforward when we're navigating the chat between us all, so that'll be fun. David, I would like to welcome you for your TFT podcast debut. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. Enjoying the last sun of the summer.
Excellent. And Dave, how are you all set for looking forward to a chat about modern football?
Some good topics we've got coming up this afternoon. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we should get stuck straight into these. We've got some really good things to talk about. So, David, if you want to sort of start us off with your theme of transformation and emerging coaching talent.
Yeah, okay. So been looking back with Kieran McKenna and looking forward with Postecoglou to things like the North London Derby. There's a nice theme running between those two. Kieran McKenna's Ipswich are kind of transformed since he went there. He's in his second season, full season in charge. In his first full season in charge, he got him promoted from the third tier. And amazingly, after what, five or six games, they're up there towards the top of the Championship, which is a very competitive league. Well, I've talked to some Ipswich fans in preparation from this. You know, they're in absolute heaven. They're in a joyful place. He's really brought hope to them that they can potentially get back to the Premier League, which is a huge step, considering that in the four seasons or so before McKenna, you know, they were very much mid-table, not even threatening to go up from the third tier. So it's interesting to think about, you know, what transformation means with football, and also where do people like Kieran McKenna come from in terms of their own development. You know, I start teaching a module in higher education tomorrow on talent identification and development, but we focus on footballers. But what about the talent identification and development of coaches? Because last English coach to get into the top four of the Premier League was, I think, Harry Redknapp, 2012, something like that. You know, the demise of the English manager since the 70s that we looked at recently, very, very steep decline. So it'd be interesting, I think, to think about that. Bearing in mind that Kieran McKenna's from Northern Ireland, I do understand that. But I'm going to talk about other coaches as well.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, isn't it, with Kieran McKenna? I think the talent identification is quite interesting in football from a management and coaching point of view, because I think historically it was a post-playing career job. Absolutely. And kind of managers and coaches kind of fell into that. There is certainly that element with McKenna that his sort of growth at Spurs and Manchester United especially really supported that development into his role at Ipswich. Dave, what have you seen of McKenna's Ipswich so far in terms of the way they play and what McKenna's sort of doing with them?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I write a lot of stuff for the Ipswich programme. I do Kieran's programme notes. So what he's done there has been fantastic. And I think you can see a lot of the strength of what he's doing in that this season they've gone into the Championship, and obviously it's, what, five, six games now. But he hasn't brought in, I mean, they brought four or five players in the summer, but he hasn't brought any of those players into the team as yet, really. It's still the team that won promotion. And that team really solidified kind of late February onwards. Before then, he was sort of chopping and changing his team, as managers do. But sort of back end of February onwards, same 11 pretty much, right the way through the last dozen games. And they were unstoppable at the end of last season. You know, I mean, I think it was up until the Leeds game they lost two or three weeks ago, I think it was 20 games unbeaten. I think it was 12 out of the last 13 games that they won. It was a ridiculous run to promotion at the end. And they broke the clean sheet record at the club, record number of minutes without conceding a goal. So he's obviously doing something right. I mean, I would give a nod to Mark Ashton, who's the chief exec there. I mean, again, I've known Mark for donkey's years, 20 years. So I would not. But he's done something similar at Ipswich to what he did initially at Watford when he went to Watford as chief exec. He found this guy called Adi Boothroyd, at that point, who was youth coach at Leeds, I think, at that stage. He'd been briefly a youth coach at West Brom. And Mark is very cute on that concept, finding a young coach who's really, really hungry to make a name for himself. That's one thing. But then you've got to find the bloke who can actually turn that into something, you know, concrete. And the way McKenna's got Ipswich playing is magnificent to watch. I mean, they've got the, they're getting 28,000-29,000 people every week now at Portman Road. It's a club that's got serious momentum. And I remember saying to somebody in the summer, I would seriously put money on them for the top six this season. Like an idiot, I didn't. It's too late now, isn't it?
They are a very impressive outfit, and the solidity that they've got in this side through consistency of performances and selection as well. It's not an accident, is it, David? It's a lot of planning. It's a lot of preparation. What kind of preparation has McKenna had, I suppose, before taking on a managerial role like Ipswich? Because it is a big club, Ipswich, and it's got a storied history. And you can't go into that job as a novice coach not understanding the football club, not understanding what the expectations are. So where does that kind of transformational journey begin for McKenna, do you think?
I'm smiling, Rob, because he's not a novice coach. He's an expert coach in novice clothing. The guy got injured at 23 and as a player. And if we want to think about the modern coaches coming through, that's a common theme. Okay, get injured early in your season, early in your career rather, and you've got a longer period of learning where you can do your apprenticeship, or what I like to call your time in the trenches, before you get the big job, so you're prepared for that. So, you know, if I think about McKenna's career, I've got pages and pages of notes here, but it's not worth me looking at them. I'll take out the highlights. So his injury was a hip injury. And as I understand it, when he had the last operation, where the surgeon basically said to him, look, sorry, mate, you're finished. He was on crutches within a week out on the field with Alex Inglethorpe and John McDermott. And they were coaching the Tottenham youths, and he was starting his coaching career. So, you know, he's plunged into that at an early age. He works his way through the age groups and he ends up coaching the under-18s. He then goes to Loughborough to study sports science. And while he's there, still does a bit of coaching for Tottenham, but also does some coaching at Nottingham Forest and one other place, I think it was. So a variety of experiences. He even coaches in Canada for a little while. Goes abroad and coaches in Canada. So we've got this breadth of experience going on. Does eventually go back to Tottenham. He's head of performance analysis at one point. Goes back into coaching. Goes to under-18s at Manchester United initially. Then gets promoted to the first coaching team. And he's an assistant coach to Mourinho, Rangnick, and Solskjaer. And Solskjaer holds him in good stead. A nice quote I got from Solskjaer was that he thinks McKenna is the most thorough and analytical, step-by-step, process-driven coach that I've ever worked with. For McKenna to have all these different experiences, and another thing I want to say about him is he's very all-rounded. You know, performance analysis, sports science. Sorry, guys, I did warn you the red arrows might go over. They're going now. So performance analysis, sports science, youth age group coaching, assistant coaching. You know, he's got the broad portfolio that makes him all-rounded and multidimensional. And I know that John McDermott was trying to produce what he called video coaches, kind of blend of a coach and a video analyst. And I know McKenna uses a lot of film footage. I'll stop there because I could go on and you can prompt me with other stuff. But that paints a picture perhaps of how his transformational journey has gone. And what talented coaches need, I think, in their development, that breadth. Not only breadth, but depth of experience. He's the youngest coach or head coach in the four top divisions at 37. But my goodness, has he got some experience between 23 and 37.
Yeah, and that's such a key point, isn't it? And I think that certainly the often chaotic kamikaze nature of the EFL in terms of player transfers, manager selections, how I think previously there's been quite a conveyor belt of managers that have just moved around very similar clubs in very similar areas. McKenna is someone who stands out somewhere quite different. Dave, someone like McKenna, who was obviously spotted for United, comes into their coaching setup, works with the first team, gets close to the managers, has got great potential, but has had to move away from Old Trafford. Do you think that's somewhat indicative of what football is like at that elite level, in the sense that he could never start out in that job? Or do you think that that may be something that changes in the future?
I think one of the problems is, had he been, you know, had Manchester United had enormous faith in when replacing Solskjaer and they'd announced him as the manager, the United fan base would have gone berserk. And, you know, it's not just identifying a coach, it's identifying a coach that the supporters will be happy with. Because if the supporters aren't happy with a management appointment, you're on a hiding to nothing before you've started. I mean, it becomes very, very difficult. There are very few coaches I can think of who, you know, go on and be a success having when the fans haven't wanted him in the first place. From United's point of view, it might not have been a bad idea. But, I mean, he's certainly got the quality. And the thing I like about him as well is he's made good choices. Ipswich was a good choice. He could see what was happening at Ipswich. Obviously, they've got some finance coming in from the American owners and all that sort of stuff. The things that David was talking about players getting injured early and going into coaching. I mean, I knew Michael Appleton really well at West Brom when he finished playing. And, I mean, he was burning with the desire to get into coaching. And he was, you know, really seething that his career had been taken from him and he wanted to put that right in coaching. And I think, you know, Michael's a case in point where he's made some poor choices, perhaps in the clubs that he's gone to. And, you know, of course, it's what's available at the time and all that sort of stuff. But I think one or two of the clubs that he's gone to haven't given him that opportunity to succeed. And, you know, good coaches make players better. But football clubs also have ceilings at different points in their history. You know, and some clubs are not particularly well run, or they haven't got the finance or the resources. And, you know, you can be in the right place at the wrong time. I think what McKenna identified at Ipswich when he got the opportunity was, this is a great place to go. This club is moving in the right direction. I'm going to be in a good place here. There was talk a couple of times last season of clubs like West Brom looking at him. Now, how serious that was and whether he ever got offered anything, I don't know. But, I mean, there was certainly no talk of him moving on. He signed a new contract at Ipswich in the summer. People can be in too much of a hurry sometimes to move on to something when, you know, sticking with what you know, doing a good job there for, you know, not necessarily 6-7 years, but if he does 2 or 3 more good years at Ipswich, there's no reason why Manchester United shouldn't come back and look out for him. But, you know, in terms of the culture of a football club, a Manchester United, a Liverpool, isn't going to go for somebody like Kieran McKenna at that stage in his career 2 years ago when he went to Ipswich.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true about signing footballers as well. And I think when we come on to talk about sort of Brighton and Manchester United and their sort of differences, there's some kind of similarities there in terms of the managers they would look at and players they would look at. As a Middlesbrough fan, I'm quite used to, in my era as a fan, 30 years or so, we've always kind of had novice managers. So Brian Robson into Steve McLaren, into Gareth Southgate. We've also had Jonathan Woodgate, and now we've got Michael Carrick, who is obviously someone that worked really closely with McKenna at United, but certainly didn't have the same sort of coaching pedigree as McKenna, obviously because of his long playing career. And, you know, we're in a bit of a predicament at the moment as a football club in terms of results on the pitch. And there's possibly some of the skills that you would learn as a coach and the experience that you have would help you get out of a situation like that. And I think that, for me, that might be something that Carrick's struggling with a little bit at the moment. He might not have that kind of awareness, that understanding, that experience, although he's, you know, been part of United for quite a long time and has seen what a successful machine looks like. And it begs the question about someone. I know we're going to talk about Ange Postecoglou as well, David, in the sense that his appointment at Spurs drew some comments about his sort of credentials for a post at a top, let's call him a top 8 Premier League side. Hopefully, they probably want to be a top 6 or a top 4 side, despite being a hugely, hugely successful manager with a very sort of exciting way of playing football and quite a well-established figure in world football, if not, you know, in English football. Are there sort of parallels with, I know Postecoglou is at a very different part of his career, but he has a similar transformative effect, doesn't he, in terms of the types of things that he wants to put in place? And he's already having that sort of effect on Spurs, isn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, I would describe Postecoglou going to Spurs as putting your head in the lion's mouth, but he's turned it into a positive project already. I'll just say a couple of things following up on what you were saying. I think what I would say about McKenna is he's increasingly and progressively taken on more responsibility. Now, a player who's starting their coaching career right at the end of a long playing career is effectively probably going to have to learn how to make mistakes on the job. They haven't got that behind them. So that puts them in a difficult position. They haven't got as much to fall back on. I'll draw a really nice parallel, I think, of the things I've been reading about McKenna and Postecoglou just before we change tack to Postecoglou. When McKenna was a youth trainee at Tottenham, at 16, his coach, who was Jimmy Neighbour, said to him, "You're going to make a really good coach when you're older." Like, this is completely out of the blue, right? And McKenna doesn't know what he sees in him, but he saw something. Patsy Holland was the youth team manager at the time, and he kept giving him leadership roles. So he ends up being captain for his club and captain for his country. Again, he said, "I don't know what they saw in me, but they saw something in me." Now, if I switch to Ange Postecoglou, I read a great story the other day that his first coaching assignment was when he was 12. His school teacher is a music teacher, but he wants to get a football team together. Gets football team together, but they haven't got a coach. Postecoglou starts doing some of the coaching and managing of things. And eventually someone says, "Well, hang on, I think we should have a vote. You know, who put you in charge?" They have the vote and he gets a unanimous vote. Postecoglou says to the guy who called the vote, "Well, what's that about?" He said, "You must have voted for me as well." He said, "Oh, yeah, I just wanted to be sure." But like, everyone thought that he was the manager, the coach at 12 years old. And he said himself that, you know, he had a playing career, but he said he's far more comfortable in management than he was in playing. Now, if we think about an ex-pro who's played for longer, they're far more comfortable in playing than they are in management. So the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu used a lovely phrase. He said, "When you feel comfortable somewhere and you fit in socially, it's like being a fish in water. But when you're otherwise, you could feel like a fish out of water. And that's a very different, uncomfortable place to be."
Yeah, and Postecoglou's had a really good start, hasn't he? And Spurs look like a real force. They're playing some really good football. I think it's very telling that Harry Kane has left. Not to say that, obviously, Harry Kane wouldn't have made a great difference this side. And obviously, he's an absolute top quality player. Bill Simmons, who works for ESPN and writes about basketball, he has a thing called the Patrick Ewing theory, where he sort of talks about Patrick Ewing as sort of the talisman for the New York Knicks for 15 years. And as soon as he leaves, I think within a couple of years, they're in the playoffs because they're sort of so attached to this sort of idea of a star player or a man to lead the team that all of the team has to function around that player. And I think Spurs, if ever a time to pick a manager like Postecoglou, now was the time because they haven't got that figure that he necessarily has to fit around. Dave, having seen some Spurs this season, they do look obviously a very different side than what they did under Antonio Conte, much more attacking, free-flowing. Do you think that his background in terms of being a manager for a long period of time in different sort of football cultures, if you like, will set him up for somewhere like Spurs, who have probably been crying out for that over the last few managers?
I think you're probably right. I mean, going back to what you were just saying, I think Ian Wright was another case at Arsenal. Everything went through Ian Wright. He scored hundreds and hundreds of goals. But, you know, when Ian Wright left, then Arsenal started, I know he was there sort of in the early phase of Wenger, but when Ian Wright left, then Arsenal started to win more and more and more. Because it's very rare that one individual player is going to make a team win things. They can make the difference in particular games within a team setting, but they're not going to make that team win over a season. And I think, you know, with Harry Kane gone, it's kind of given, it's a clean sheet of paper at Tottenham for him to come into, and he can build something different. It just made me laugh when he came in and people were saying, "Oh yeah, I mean, he's only coming from Scotland. I mean, the pressure at Tottenham, the pressure at Celtic is fairly considerable, let me tell you." I think he knows how to handle the pressure, and he's taken to it really, really nicely. I think, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but I think, you know, Napoleon's thing about lucky generals is a thing as well. And I think he's one of those guys who, I don't know if it's luck or what, but when he needs a result, when he needs something to happen, he's one of those guys where things do happen. I mean, you know, this weekend was a perfect case in point. Had they lost at home to Sheffield United, all the naysayers would have been out. But all of a sudden, there's a sending off. They scored two goals in the last, in what, 7-8 minutes of added time, whatever it is. They're second in the table. The bandwagon's marching on, and now they can look forward to playing Arsenal next weekend, you know, in what's a proper test. I've got a lot of time for him, having seen quite a bit of Scottish football over the last couple of years. Obviously, Celtic have got the inherent advantage up there. But the way they played, the sort of swagger they played with, it's very much in that sort of Spurs tradition. You know, the glory, glory, Tottenham Hotspur, Danny Blanchflower, all that kind of stuff. It's very much in the way that Tottenham are supposed to play the game. I think he'll be a big success there. I'm not quite sure what a success means for Tottenham in the modern game. That's a whole different story. I mean, I don't see Tottenham being in a position where they're going to go and win the Premier League, because you've got Manchester City for a starter. But I think Tottenham can, you know, look at competing for the European places. They can, you know, look at winning an FA Cup. They can look at pushing for the Champions League, maybe. And I think, you know, going back to where we started, the Harry Kane thing, that it's kind of lancing the boil. You can't just look at Harry Kane now. He's going to solve everything for us. We've got to solve it as a collective. I think that's a real step forward for Tottenham, actually.
Yeah, and I think the addition of some of, you know, players like James Maddison really helps, because it fits in that Postecoglou style. He's a flair player, he's creative, he gets fans off the seat. I think from what happened with Gareth Bale, when they tried to sort of wholesale replace Bale with, you know, a lot of different players and spend a lot of money on them, I think that really did hamstring them in terms of what it was. I did actually think that Postecoglou was going to suffer from that manager of the month curse when I saw that they were 1-0 down after sort of, what was it, 97 minutes, I think, before they'd even scored the first goal. It's quite interesting. Just to finish and round off this one, David, Postecoglou and McKenna have made great starts to the season. Do you think that their background helps the success to be sustainable for both of these clubs? For me, I don't think it's a flash in the pan that Spurs have made a good start or McKenna's had a good start. Do you think this kind of experience and McKenna's, you know, obviously outside the dugout as a coach, but Postecoglou in various leagues where he's actually won a lot of trophies, let's not forget, that helps support that sustainability for the club, doesn't it?
Yeah, sustainable success is a phrase that Postecoglou uses a lot. The only game he's lost so far is the Carabao Cup game, right? They made 9 changes and they got a bit of criticism for that. His answer was, I don't just want to win the Carabao Cup as a kind of flash in the pan. I want to have sustainable success. And it's not that he doesn't want to win that game, but, you know, he needs to rotate the players, etc. So what he means by sustainable success is not just winning a trophy for Tottenham, and that seems like the holy grail at this moment, but he means winning trophies, you know, and that is his genuine aim. And he's not being deluded in that. He'll need to build up to it. I think he said the other day he needs 2 more transfer windows to start getting what he wants with the team. But he is after sustainable success. And in terms of his background and McKenna's background, Postecoglou's got a great humility for me. I love that quality in a coach. I think it's really important in emerging talent as coaches, because if you haven't got humility, then you don't keep learning. And you've got to keep learning because the game keeps changing and the situations change. So although I've said he's got humility, one of the things he said repeatedly in an interview recently was that he's been successful wherever he's been. And it's hard to argue against that. And he's been a lot of places. You could say the same for McKenna. He's been successful wherever he's been, but he's a constant learner. He's someone who's going to adapt and change. Postecoglou is tactically flexible. Okay, he's got an attacking philosophy. When they play Arsenal, and we can look forward to that North London derby now with Tottenham having an unbeaten record and a run of momentum, as Dave said, he's not going to go out and play defensively against Arsenal. He might tweak how he plays, but it'll be horses for courses, you know, however he sets it up. But he's going to set up with an attacking philosophy. So I think both of them, yeah, their background helps them, and I think both of them are in it for the long haul and certainly in it with a long vision. I know McKenna is like got a target on his back, right? That people, I think Dave said West Brom might have been looking at him. You know, everybody thinks he might coach a top team at some point. Who knows? Man United he supported, by the way. That's why he went there. So he might end up at Man United. He might end up a Spurs coach. Who knows? But there's the possibility that he genuinely is trying to get Ipswich to the Premier League with himself at the helm. And as Dave alluded to earlier, he's got a nice new management group in there that support him with that as well. I think people criticise him somewhat, saying that they bought their way out of the third tier, but I don't buy that. If you look at their transfer record, it's not profligate. They don't chuck money at the wall. They're savvy purchases and they sell well as well. So if you look at it, their books are pretty well balanced. So in answer to your question, yeah, I think their background helps them both to look at sustainable success for a club. And if you're a fan, that's so exciting, isn't it? And that's some of the joy and transformation they've brought. When I brought up the theme of transformation, I don't just mean players and club, by the way. So what's the phrase you brought up, basketball, earlier? John Wooden once said, a good coach can change a game, a great coach can change a life. So, you know, good coaches want to coach people as well as players. And if I talk about the broader extent, when Clough and Taylor were at Derby and it was all going well, production at the Rolls-Royce factory went up. You know, so like they can affect the broader remit as well.
Yeah, and that's such an important point, isn't it? Sitting here, like I say, as a Borough fan, we got Carrick instead of McKenna, and Ipswich's two central midfielders are Massimo Luongo and Sam Morsi, who were both ex-Middlesbrough players. Considering the chasm that we've got in the centre of our pitch at the moment, it doesn't make for nice reading, but there you go. We'll leave that one to one side for now. Moving into sustainability, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring with the topic for us. It was Manchester United versus Brighton yesterday. Obviously, Brighton came out fantastic winners in a 3-1 victory. And it's kind of really a tale of two clubs for me at the moment. As someone who grew up with football in the 1990s, Manchester United were the force in the league. They were the only team you ever really saw playing against the best teams in Europe. You saw them develop and change over time. Ferguson changed his tactics, added different players. Obviously, had a lot of money at that time generated by the club and owners. But now we're at a position where Brighton have sort of introduced a model that everybody sort of wants to copy. All the so-called smaller clubs want to do a Brighton or do a Brentford, and that's their model, rather than Tony Bloom when he first set out trying to make Brighton and keep them in the league, help them survive. Now they're at a point where they're really well run. They've got really good policy in terms of replacing managers, CEOs, or basically anyone that Chelsea wants or needs to be replaced at some point. There's a tweet after the game, I think it was, about the Manchester United Brighton, and it was about the Brighton lineup from Kieran Maguire, who talks about the price of football. Out of their starting 11, 9 of the players cost a total of £7.9 million, which is quite incredible, really, when you see a team like Manchester United, who have just been confirmed as having the most expensive squad in world football, basically, almost £1 billion to make the squad that they had. And really, I think it's looking at these big clubs and thinking about what are they actually doing in terms of talent spotting, talent development, where the money's going. You look at United's transfers this summer, they signed Rasmus Højlund for €75 million, Mason Mount for €65 million, and Andre Onana for €52 million. They spent over €206 million this summer, which is quite incredible. And I don't necessarily think they've become a better team for it as yet. Dave, it's been a tricky sort of 10 years for United in the post-Ferguson era, shall we say. Do you think this is symptomatic of a lot of big clubs in the sense that they've almost got maybe a little bit too much money, a little bit too much power when they're trying to sign these players and they can't really run that sustainable model because of a little bit what you were saying before about fans wanting certain players, certain managers? Do you think that's now befell United and kind of they feel like they need to follow that track rather than maybe developing the club overall?
I think there are all sorts of things about Manchester United. I don't think any of us quite realised just how massive the task of replacing Alex Ferguson was. Maybe, you know, obviously everybody knew he was going to be a hard act to follow, but I don't think anybody quite got just how difficult it was. I think, you know, he was one of the last of the old school Clough, Shankly type managers where he managed the football club and he managed everything. He was in charge of the whole thing. And he, you know, one of his great skills at the end of it was that he managed to manage the Glazers and the new thing that Manchester United had become after they bought the football club. And I remember going to Old Trafford, I think about 3 months after Ferguson left, 3 months into the David Moyes season. I was walking in there to work for West Brom, and you could feel it was different. There was just, I don't know, it's very hard to put your finger on it, but that aura that it had got around it had gone. Just overnight, it had gone. Yeah, I mean, yeah, as a minor club in the Premier League like West Brom, you used to turn up at Old Trafford thinking, well, how many will we lose by? and we didn't always lose, but you know, whatever. And then we went there with David Moyes, and we won. The first time Albion won there since that famous 5-3 in 78. And everything just felt differently. And I think there's been nobody at United who has been able to control it. There's too many cooks at the top. I don't know what it is, you know, whether it's been the background, not giving managers enough time, picking the wrong managers. I mean, certainly there's been an obsession over the piece with, we've got to buy glamour players, we've got to buy big names, we've got to have the star, we've got to break the transfer record, because that's what Manchester United do. And none of it's worked. I mean, you have Paul Pogba. I mean, I happen to be quite a fan of Pogba because I've seen a lot of him at Juventus, where he has made a difference and he has been a significant player, and obviously with France. At Manchester United, it never really worked for any length of time. They've gone through managers like water. There's nobody there at the helm, at the top of the club, that's got control of it. You talk about Brighton. A lot of the foundations at Brighton, I think, were put in place by Dan Ashworth, who, again, I know quite well from West Brom. And he did the same thing at West Brom. He was there when we found players like Yusuf Malumbu, Jonas Olsen, Graham Dorans, who we bought for nothing, you know, absolute buttons. And, OK, they didn't then go on and become world beaters, but they were good enough to keep the Albion in the Premier League for 5, 6, 7 years, and they did a fantastic job, and they're all cult heroes at the Hawthorn still, you know. And that was Dan's ability to spot that sort of stuff. But he was also, I remember writing a piece with him when he was the sporting director or whatever title he had, when Di Matteo was doing well at the Albion. And in this piece he said, and at the moment we're looking for Robbie's successor. And there was uproar in the local press, the Expression Star went mad. But all he was saying was, well, look, if he's doing well, he'll go and manage Chelsea or whoever. And if things go badly, we'll end up having to get rid of him, and you know, we'll get somebody else in. That idea of looking two or three pieces down, you know, two or three moves down the chessboard, that's logical, isn't it? But there are precious few football clubs that run that way. Most football clubs are reactive. The great thing with Brighton is that after Dan left, they've still managed to carry on doing exactly the same thing, which is hugely impressive, because I can tell you the Albion didn't. But you know, that ability to look into the future and to plot yourself three or four moves down the chessboard, that is a great skill, and it's working fantastically well at Brighton.
Yeah, I totally agree, Dave. David, is that something that chimes for you as well, kind of the way that these bigger clubs are starting to be run now? Maybe they're only looking one move ahead, where some of these smarter clubs outside the top six are having to look at three, four, five moves ahead. Brentford's always an example that I use. You know, Middlesbrough were starting this cycle of long-term development, signing players for the long term. I think Brentford sold their top scorer something like 3 or 4 years in a row before they found Ivan Toney and actually got promoted, and they can constantly sort of prepare. I mean, you could argue now that they don't actually need an Ivan Toney type player, they could possibly sell him, but in terms of United and Brighton, is that one of the biggest sort of culture differences between them in terms of how they're run as football clubs?
Yeah, I think if you've got loads of money, it's tempting to buy success quickly or attempt to buy success quickly. And what you do then is you go out and you buy star individuals, right? But then you've got a group of individuals. You know, Man City chucked a lot of money at things for a long time and it wasn't quite clicking for them. It's only when it becomes a project and when the team becomes more than the sum of their parts do we start to get something that's sustainable in terms of success. And I think that's when the first step with that is you've got to establish an organisational culture and an organisational identity that's coherent and that people can buy into. And, you know, I think from what Dave's saying, that's what Dan Ashworth does, right, at his level. What's the current Manchester United manager's battles, Ten Hag? They seem to be cultural battles, don't they? You know, he's trying to establish, you know, is the star bigger than the group? And you know, how do you treat someone who's supposedly stepping out of line? I know we don't know all of that, but he seems to be having cultural battles. I think if you can establish who you are and what your culture is, what your identity is, then you're using your money not to buy star individuals, but to buy the right fit of individuals and the right fit of coach. And then if you've got that, if a Potter leaves, and it looks disastrous, but if there's a strong organisational culture and identity, that remains. And if an Ashworth moves on, that remains. So it's that, it's having and establishing that clear culture and identity, I think, that is it for me. And the opposite of that is where Chelsea got themselves, where they had too many players and far too many players out on loans, you know, and they've got to clear that mess up. And my word, are they having a problem clearing that mess up? You know, because where's their identity? What are we about?
It's a very difficult situation for Ten Hag at the moment because it feels like there's so many things going on off the pitch for him that actually concentrating on the pitch actions is quite challenging, especially if the results are not going your way, maybe if the players aren't signing. For me, I think the Rasmus Højlund sign, I think, is quite indicative of United's problems, really. There they've signed someone who's possibly going to be a very good player in 3 or 4 years' time, which is when United would normally have bought him. Maybe if he'd gone to, I don't know, another team, a team in Spain or a team in France, maybe he'd gone to Dortmund, a little bit like Haaland, and they would have bought him after that. But for me, they've kind of paid the price for what they think he's going to be like when he's 24, 4 years early. And I think that Mason Mount signing's another one where, you know, another high-profile club are wanting to sell one of their high-profile players. Therefore, it sounds like that would be a sensible player for us to buy. When really, if you look at United's midfield, they didn't need Mason Mount. He wasn't the type of player that they need, and Ten Hag certainly wouldn't have had someone like that. I think one of the things about Ten Hag, I'll bring you in on this, Dave, is that his Ajax side that was so exciting was a very different profile of player, young, up-and-coming players. You could argue it was probably more similar to Brighton than United, and I appreciate Ajax is an enormous club and has got such a storied history, but they are more that type of team, aren't they? Young, developing. Like you were saying, David, you can build a culture a little bit more simply with younger players because they're desperate to do well. They really want to make a name for themselves. Do you think he's suffering with a little bit of that, Dave, in terms of, like you said, the actual scale of the job that it takes to actually get a club like United to be successful?
Absolutely, he is. I mean, you know, it's the old joke. How do I get to such and such? Well, I wouldn't start from here. And that's the point with Manchester United. I wouldn't start from where they are. Somebody's got to fix that. At Ajax, I mean, Ajax has always had that reputation of being the club that brings the young players through and as a way of playing and all that. And that's what Manchester United always was, the Busby Babes, the Fergie Fledglings, the Class of 92, all that stuff. That's what Manchester United were about. And they've lost that completely, really, over the last, well, post-Ferguson, perhaps even before Ferguson went, you know. We were talking, I think, in the 70s series about that was the final decade where it wasn't all about money and money wasn't the big conversation before you start. Money is now the conversation that you have before you get to the football. And that's changed absolutely everything. And Ten Hag has got all these players that this manager wanted, that manager wanted, that these supporters wanted. That it's just a mishmash of all kinds of things without any kind of coherent direction to it. And I think he did a reasonable job last season. 7 out of 10, as they used to say in the newspapers. So, but if he wants to get Manchester United to where Manchester United were, he's got to do 12 out of 10. Because the landscape's changed. You know, Manchester United were the big club. Manchester United were the ones that had all the money. They had the clout. They had the pull. And now it's Manchester City. And you've not only got to turn Manchester United into a good team, which is possible, you've got to turn them into a better team than Manchester City, which at the moment is looking impossible, or certainly something that's a long, long way off. I mean, I wouldn't want his job. I wouldn't want his money. I wouldn't want his job. I wouldn't want the pressure that comes with that. And I wouldn't want to be doing it from where he's starting because there are too many things wrong at Manchester United. And, you know, I mean, Harry Maguire, I feel sorry for Harry Maguire. I don't think anybody should be put through the stuff that he's being put through. But equally, if you've got a bloke like Harry Maguire who won't leave when it's palpably obvious that he's not going to be playing football this season, that is a bad sign at a football club. I mean, I want footballers who want to play. Okay, I also want footballers who understand that they're not going to play every week in the way the modern game is and all of that stuff. But I want footballers who think if they do their best, they're going to be in the first team. They're going to be the first pick for the big matches and all that. Harry Maguire clearly isn't, but he's happy to stay at Manchester United. That's a bad sign. There's too many things wrong at Manchester United, and it will take a long time to put right. And I think from United's perspective, they need to let Ten Hag try and do it for 3-4 seasons rather than, you know, I don't know, if things are bad at Christmas, oh, here we go again. We'll get rid of him. We'll bring somebody else in. you've got to let somebody have a proper go at imposing, as David says, the new culture on the place.
Yeah, I think one comparison that I'm certain that United and Liverpool fans won't like to hear is that when Ferguson arrived at United, it was all about, you know, knocking Liverpool off the perch. But I do also think as well, from a Liverpool point of view, certainly around the Brendan Rodgers era and after that, they realised they didn't have the spending power of other teams. So they needed to get better at everything else off the pitch that they could afford to spend money on. Therefore, that would allow them to buy, let's say in inverted commas, I hate saying undervalued players in the market when they sign a goalkeeper for 75 million and a centre-back for... It's just crazy, isn't it, when, you know, your own club spends £3 million on a strike and you think, why isn't he scoring with every one-on-one or whatever? But I think Liverpool had that thought process of, right, we can't just spend because we haven't got the resources because we're not in the Champions League every year. We're not a, you know, we're a top eight team now rather than a top three team. I think they really did that smartly. Obviously, City did the same and spent the money. So I think they're obviously a very sort of team on their own. But it is that idea, David. I suppose it goes a little bit back to what we're talking about with Postecoglou and McKenna, in the sense you've got to marry those things up. You've got to marry up the spending power that you've got and the systems that you've got behind the scenes. And Brighton have really got that at the moment. You could argue a team like Newcastle have got that. City have clearly got that. Arsenal have clearly got that. United, it still, for me, hasn't really sunk in for them. I don't think that you need to have that whole package now to be a really thoroughly modern football club, don't you?
Yeah, I think some really interesting things there. I mean, Dave alluded to the fact that, you know, the world's moved on and Man United haven't changed their identity. You alluded to the fact, Rob, that the world moved on and Liverpool did change their identity or change their processes. And if we go back to Postecoglou and McKenna, we're talking about people that have established or are trying to establish a sustainable process. Now, that's going to have to be looked at from a helicopter view, what it means. And also, you're going to have to need to change it. So we said earlier that McKenna's a meticulous planner, but he also adjusts, you know, and he adapts. So you've got to have both. I think I read an Isaac Asimov quote the other day of all people. He said, planning is important. Planning is important, but it's not enough. You've also got to improvise. So you've got to do things on the hoof, even if you've got that experience behind you. You've got to be willing to change and be open-minded. You talked about Ajax, you know, and their academy is famously called Die Toekomst, which is the future. You know, and you've got to have one eye on the future. And as Cruyff used to say to his players, if there's a problem, I want you to solve it before it happens. It's almost got to be that way of looking forward. And you know, going back to Brighton, I mean, they're clearly doing a good job of planning succession, aren't they? And David alluded to earlier, you know, looking for who do we bring in if this manager goes? Who do we bring in if this player goes? And they're going to have to think that because you have to cut your cloth to who you are. And part of establishing cultures and identities is working out who you are as a club. What do you stand for? What don't you stand for? Who are you? What aren't you? And I think sometimes there's not enough introspection and we get out of kilter with the world. It's moved on and we've got that lag. And as Dave alludes to, that's where Ten Hag is kind of stuck in a swamp, you know, and things have changed. It's very difficult for him. I agree with Dave. I wouldn't want that project for the world.
And you're going to tell us a little bit, David, about Burnley and their women's team. The men's team, obviously, last year had some fantastic success. I would argue on and off the pitch with the change in approach completely over the course of a summer in terms of the scouting network. They're signing a lot of players from what we would call, you know, leagues outside the top five or minor European leagues, whatever you want to call them. But they're starting to put systems in place that may allow them to have another sustainable period, hopefully for them in the Premier League. They may well come down again and bounce up again, and then you kind of restart that. But and Burnley women are also trying to sort of ape some of those methods as well, aren't they?
Yeah. So had a chat yesterday with the female manager of Burnley women. I hold my hand up here and say I'm completely biased. I worked with this person for several years. They were a lecturer in sports coaching with me. And we were a great team, I think, helping people develop young coaches, part of that emerging talent bit. She stepped away from a job where she was very secure. She was head of all football at Loughborough University. Big job, doing well in it. She stepped away to the insecure world of third-tier women's football and took on the Burnley project. Burnley 2 years ago were fourth. Last year they were third. you know, they're really trying to go for promotion. There's only one team gets promoted, I believe. But they're doing that from a process coach point of view again. So McKenna's a process coach. Bex is a process coach as well. It's Rebecca Salyuk. So I said to her, are you enjoying it? She said she's loving the role. She feels like she's where she's supposed to be at present. Although it's a bit of a leap of faith, she said she's got this new opportunities to make meaningful relationships with players as people. And there's that thing again about not just developing players, but developing them as people as well. She said she's got the opportunity to be a better leader and a manager. And she said it's so much more than X's and O's. And that's one thing I'd say about coaching. It's more than X's and O's, and it's more than coaching awards and badges. Far more. Got to have a broader education, broader perspective. I said to her, you know, have they aligned themselves with the men's team? And apparently company gave a speech to the women's team about what it means to be Burnley, which I think is really nice. And the men's team have allowed the women to use the performance analysis suite, the brand new suite. And he gave them a little speech on what a privilege it is to be debriefed in that quality of room. And it's nice they've invited the women in to use that as well. So I was checking in with her yesterday because, and the last thing I did before coming on this podcast was check a result here, right? It just came through. It was like the old teleprinter in the 70s. So they were playing Nottingham Forest today, Burnley women. Burnley women were first. Forest were second in the league, but have a game in hand. Burnley women have never beaten Nottingham Forest. Forest are on a 16-game unbeaten streak. Their first game of the season, they won 7-1. And Burnley won 4-2 today. I told you, I'm partisan today. So I'm hoping that Bex is doing a transformational job there. And I'm hoping that, you know, she's going to take Burnley up to the next tier. And I love the way that they've aligned with the men's team. Because for whatever they're struggling with the step up at the moment, last year was a great success. They were one of the greatest championship sides for a very long time. So it's really nice that they're aligning. It's really nice that she's got a new challenge and making a positive impact. And again, it's someone who's gone in there and is kind of transforming what might be possible in the future. But she's got it with a broad view and a process coach view. It's not about, as Postecoglou said the other day, it's not just about winning games. It's how we win games and who are we and what do we represent as Burnley women.
We've talked a lot about culture throughout the podcast. We've talked a lot about football as a game for people and coaching people. Dave, your topic is, you know, one of those topics in football that we kind of wish that we didn't have to talk about when you talk about the politics of the game and the people who affect the game, maybe without any given right to affect the game in such a way that they do. But I know that you want to talk to us today a little bit about how those sort of political elements of the football game have been amplified, shall we say, over the last few months.
I do. I mean, I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with this, so you'll have to help me as we go along. I'm getting very postmodern because I'm looking back at the stuff that we've done on this podcast in the last 2 weeks, yourself and Alex and Steve, and talking about Rubiales and the goings on in Spain. I mean, all I can do is echo all the stuff that you've said over the last 2 weeks, the idea that rumbled on for so long before finally the inevitable happened and he eventually stood down. I mean, you know, you would have thought that at some point somebody would have said, okay, here's the revolver, take it into the darkened room and off you go. I mean, that was the inevitable conclusion. There's no two ways about it. Everything should have happened on the spot, really, shouldn't it? It should have happened at the day after the World Cup final. And then, you know, you draw a line in the sand. You can celebrate what you've done. You can celebrate your achievement. And you move on. I mean, it's just ruined the whole achievement and the whole thing. But it's interesting how those shifts now are happening from, it used to be countries that we were shocked and appalled by rather than individuals. I mean, David will remember the days of the 70s and the 80s where we wouldn't play cricket against South Africa. And there were the Olympic boycotts of Moscow and Los Angeles and stuff. And now, you know, Rubiales, it's a scandal, absolutely. There's no question about it. But we've just had a World Cup in Qatar. Saudi Arabian money is buying up football clubs and footballers left, right and centre. You know, but Jordan Henderson's the bad guy. I don't know how this happens. I mean, I'm not defending Jordan Henderson. I think he's done his reputation no good at all. At the same time, if somebody's going to offer you £700,000 a week as an individual, and the game is taking no action as a whole against a particular country, why don't you take the £700,000 a week? I can understand his point of view in that. It's just that football wants to, you know, it'll wear its armbands and it'll wear its fancy rainbow laces and it'll call for diversity and equality and every football club will, you know, change its badge depending on whether it's Black History Month or whether it's, you know, the Chinese New Year or, you know, whichever particular festival it is that we... And then you look at the top and where are we going with the game? You know, should we be playing in Qatar? Should we be allowing football to take place in Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia to be a player in the world game? And then equally, I accept, where do you stop? You know, there was no UN resolution for the invasion of Iraq. Should we chuck England? Should we chuck England and America and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland at the World Cup? You do come into a position where you can be going on and on and on forever. I appreciate that, but you know, we've come to a position where there's nobody in the room, adult enough, big enough to say that country is wrong, and we've got to take a stance against that country the way we did against South Africa. But instead, we're going to have a kick at some of these individuals instead, and they're going to be the ones to blame. I'm not sticking up for Jordan Henderson, but equally, I don't think Jordan Henderson is the biggest problem in amongst all of this.
No, I tend to agree, actually, Dave, and I think I live in Liverpool, and all of my friends are Reds, and they've obviously had quite a bit to say about Henderson moving, and there's quite a lot of support for him, and I think what has happened, I think, because Henderson's form may have suffered at Liverpool the last year, he's been an easy target to criticise. And then he goes to Saudi Arabia. It makes it twice as easy to sort of, you know, put him through the door. They're more than happy to take £50 million for Fabinho, who looked like his legs had gone last season. You're quite happy to take that. And I think there's quite a bit of a contradiction, isn't there, in terms of, well, I don't want that person to play in that league. But really, if we could get £70 million for those two, that would be a great deal, because that'll pay for part of Darwin Núñez, or that'll pay for, you know, Gakpo, whoever they've, you know, that they're still paying off of transfers. But I do think a lot of it, David, I don't know if you agree, but a lot of it is down to culture, like we've said before with these football clubs. FIFA and, you know, UEFA and all these organisations, they're very much kind of individuals, Rubiales especially, individuals trying to put their fingerprint on organisations rather than running an organisation with an actual focus and purpose in mind. I mean, you could stretch that to any form of political discussion, I suppose. But in football, more so, more recently, I almost feel like we shouldn't know who the UEFA president is or the FIFA president is or who the president of the Spanish FA is, because they should just be running the football in their country or continent or whatever to whatever end gets it for players, fans, etc.
They should be running things in the service of the game. Mm. Just in the same way as our politicians should be running things in the service of the people that elect them. But sadly, I don't think either of those are true. And in an era of neoliberalism, people mess up at the top and there's a lack of accountability that they're held to at the top. And people at the bottom get the blame. I'm not going to say Jordan Henderson's at the bottom of anything, but relatively in the ecological food chain. You know, there's an excess of projected responsibility on people at the lower levels. Oh, it was consensual. You know, like, we put it on the person. We don't put it on the culture and the organisation, what's acceptable and what's not. You know, it would have been far better, as we've said, you know, if he'd held his hands up, said, got a bit carried away, didn't mean to do anything. But I guess, culturally, we need to understand that, as I understand it, from what I've read, a non-consensual kiss in Spain is, you know, actually sexual assault. So that's why I think he's got defensive, but it's also the fact that at the top, there's denial. Like, at the top, there's denial in politics. Trust is very low in those big organisations at the top, whether it's governments or whether it's sport. And there's a sense that we talk about inclusivity, as Dave said, and quite appropriately, but inclusivity is for everyone, people at the top and at the bottom. You know, we're all in it together, but in a real way, that should be. You know, we can't say we're all in it together and then not hold people at the top to what you hold the people at the bottom to. You know, it's been such a distraction from Spain's amazing achievement, and such a distraction from wonderful things like the performance of Bon Mati, which I thought was absolutely stunning. You know, and we should be talking about things like that. And we're talking about this, but we have to, because it affects everything and it affects perceptions.
Dave, do you think football will get a political reset?
No. I mean, I think, you know, the stuff that David just said about the wider world, the political world, it comes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago about money. Money has become such an all-pervasive thing over the last sort of 30, 40 years. It's just taking control of everything, and people make every decision with an eye on how much money am I going to get for this? What kind of a bung am I going to be able to take? Is this going to move me further up the greasy pole? That's what it's about now, rather than doing things for the good of the game. As David put it, I think, you know, I think that's a perfect way to sum it up. We don't have people who do things for the good of the game anymore.
I was going to talk about the Matthew effect, which you've probably heard about, which is the widening between the gap between the rich and the poor. And it's usually used in terms of financial. But if I make a point to you that backs up what I think we've been discussing, is that there's a morality gap that's growing between the top and the bottom, you know, and that's something that's happening in our game, but it's something that's happening in our politics as well. I don't think it's going to reset either, but we've got to try and do something about this somehow, but it's a big problem. And we talked about the positivities of culture earlier. This is the flip side. This is the dark side of culture.
Yeah, and I think football being such a huge global sport, I think it's got a massive role to play. And I do think sometimes the lawmakers who are in charge of football realise that it has that as well. And that's why they shy away from it, because it is such a huge area that they need to develop, to discuss, to provide guidance for people for, even just the conduct of its players, its fans, its own officials. I think it's wanting quite a lot of the time, I think. And the Rubiales fiasco, I mean, Dave, we've had, you've edited these podcasts, we've talked, this is the third time we've talked about this, but it is true, something that you said earlier, isn't it, that we end up talking about non-football things a lot of the time, more than football, don't we? It'd be great to have a podcast where we talk about, you know, the merits of a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-4-2 coming back in fashion, but it is true, isn't it, Dave? I mean, especially this calendar year, if you think we've had Qatar, about the Rubiales fiasco, and we've had the Saudi PIF spending an awful lot of money in football, it does feel like quite a momentous set of events, doesn't it, that have happened over that period of time?
There's an element where I think people at the top feel that they can get away with anything, because by and large they are. And, you know, Rubiales probably is perhaps in that sort of mindset. I'm at the pinnacle, I'm at the peak, I'm untouchable. Then there's all the other sort of falling over for money. I mean, Qatar should never have had the World Cup, really, should it? It's pretty simple. I mean, you know, you can make the spurious argument about you go in there, and Formula One does this, doesn't it? We go in there and we're showing them how to behave and what, you know, what a modern world looks like. Well, are you really? Yeah, or are you just taking an enormous amount of money for putting on a sporting event? Well, of course that's what you're doing. And that's what the World Cup was about. You can't pretend and you can't try to take the moral high ground and then have your football beginning to be dominated by countries where there are grades of people, and some people are illegal just by the virtue of who and what they are. We shouldn't be playing football with people like that, in the same way that we didn't play cricket with South Africa because they had different grades of people.
Yeah, there is a precedent that's been set for events like this, and we do think, well, people like to think we're in a more forward-thinking modern world, but maybe, as always, probably through history, we're repeating the mistakes of the past and probably not acting soon enough on them. That was a great discussion about the things that are happening in football right at the moment. I think, looking forward, probably one of the things that has changed football so much in terms of financial point of view is the Champions League, changes to European competitions. That's coming back into play this week. We've got a North London derby coming up next weekend. One of the things I wanted to sort of bring into it, and David, I think this kind of sums up a little bit about where modern football is at in terms of a club without a plan, maybe a club now without a buyer, or if rumours, you know, online are to be believed. Everton have apparently agreed a deal with a group to buy the club, who possibly may not buy the club because of how many debts there are and previous owners might call in things that need to be paid. But Everton as a football club are quite symptomatic of some of those issues, aren't they, in terms of what can go wrong if you put money before you put culture and sort of that development of a whole football club rather than just they're going about things kind of, we'll buy this player, we'll buy that player, we'll get this manager, we'll get that manager. They kind of exemplify that more than anything, don't they, at the moment?
I think so. I mean, it's felt like a sinking ship for a long time, which is a really sad thing to say because it's such a rich historical club. You know, relegation would be disastrous, wouldn't it, and unprecedented. But they felt like a long time, for a long time, like they make knee-jerk reactions and like short-termism is the way they are. You know, they've had some great players in there and great coaches. I mean, they had Ancelotti in there not so long ago. You know, we're talking about one of the greatest coaches in history, but he couldn't make a dent. So, yeah, there seems to be something very wrong. And I don't know what it is, but it's very difficult to dig yourself out of that hole. They've been spiralling down for quite a long time now and just missing the drop. And you just feel like it's a matter of time at the moment. And even the owners, then you can't get the owners in because you're unattractive enough. You know, that creates even more uncertainty. Can you imagine being a player at a club with this level of uncertainty? And that starts to affect everything.
Yeah, hugely. Dave, do you think they'll ever get a deal done?
Well, I mean, when the previous deal was done, it seemed like, oh, this is a new dawn for Everton Football Club and everything's going to be okay now. We've got loads of money coming in and we're going to... And all that's happened is it's got worse and worse and worse. Obviously, the new stadium is on the way. So that's a step forward in a sense. But you'd only be planning a new stadium in the Championship. I mean, I feel for... David's mentioned Ancelotti. I feel for him a little bit in that they got Ancelotti, which was a real coup when they brought him in. And they were starting to move in a positive direction. And then Real Madrid came back for him and that was that put the kibosh on that. But since then, it's been just a catastrophe, hasn't it? Yeah, they've got away with it on the last day of the season, what, two or three times in a row? It's not looking particularly promising for this season already, you know, six games in. And yeah, whatever people think about Sean Dyche, and, you know, I know he wasn't necessarily the first choice for a lot of Everton fans when he came in last year. He gets teams organised and he knows what he's doing. He plays the way he plays. You would have felt that Sean Dyche, with the additional resources of an Everton compared with what you can work with at Burnley, would have been able to take that team forward sufficiently. No, okay, you're not talking about they're going to make a dent in the Premier League, but you think, you know, okay, we'll be 12th this season. We'll be comfortable. We're not going to be caught up in any scrapes. And that'd be progress. That'd be a nice season for Everton. Get 12th, win most of your home games, pick up a few points away from home, and have a nice, quiet, nothing of a season. And, you know, move forward. Go to your new stadium and move on again. And it's just been another disaster. And it's not looking like it's going to get any better.
Yeah, it felt like that Dyche was the manager they maybe needed all that time ago, didn't it, when they went through so many others?
Yeah, again, maybe it's the right bloke in the right place at the wrong time.
I think one club who's got it right, Dave, you're going to finish us off with our sort of looking forward. One of the clubs that's got it right over a long, long period of time with very, very little money is your final topic for us to look forward to. And it's a little bit about Luton Town.
Garth Crooks this week going on about he can't take Luton Town seriously, which, coming from the fella who's had the worst elocution lessons this side of Alf Ramsey, is a bit rich. Whatever happens to Luton Town this season, and whether they go down by a mile, it's just a fantastic story. This is what football is all about. I mean, again, you know, going back to the 80s and early 90s, they were a weird mix. People liked Luton for David Pleat and Ricky Hill and Brian Steed and the League Cup win, and hated Luton for the plastic pitch and David Evans and the ID cards. So they were always, you know, a bit Marmite-y as a team. But you look at that last sort of 15 years, you know, from 06 when they finished 10th in the Championship, you know, relegated from the Championship, from League One and League Two in consecutive seasons. Missed out in the playoffs in the conference, had 5 years in the conference before they finally came back. 4 years in League Two. Promoted from League Two eventually. First in League One. Sixth in the Championship. Third in the Championship. Back into the top flight. Having missed the Premier League by being relegated by 2 points in 91-92. So missing out on the inaugural Premier League. And who knows what difference that might have made to Luton's future. I think the idea that you can go all that way down, you can go absolutely to rock bottom and all the financial irregularities that they've had and still somehow manage to put it together that you can come all the way back through the pyramid and up to the pinnacle of playing in the Premier League. I know David's got points to make about the way that they've brought the community with them as well. But I mean, how you can say that you can't take that seriously, I think it's just an absolute nonsense. And okay, they've had a rough start, but as we're looking ahead, I mean, there's an interesting end to the month for them. They play Wolves at home next weekend. They've got a League Cup tie away at Exeter. And then they play at Everton, which can't imagine Everton are looking forward to too much, given what we just said about them. They win those two league games and all of a sudden it's a different kettle of fish. The same as Forest last year, who obviously did it in a completely different way by going out and buying anything that moved. But any team that comes up and ruffles the Premier League is a good thing as far as I'm concerned. And hopefully Luton Town can do that. But even if they don't, that's a bloody good story. That's the kind of story that, you know, we used to fawn over in football, and I think it's a shame that we don't anymore. And yeah, we have people like Garth Crooks saying, oh, the Premier League should be for serious football clubs. Well, I don't know what that means. If you've managed to do what Luton have done, you're a serious football club as far as I'm concerned.
When I saw that quote, I couldn't quite believe that he actually said it, and it was actually out there in the real world. You know, you might say that with your friends after a couple of pints in the pub, you think, oh, what are they doing? You know what I mean? Yeah. But if anyone's seen his teams of the week that he does for the Premier League, I think we all know how serious Garth Crooks is about organising football players on a pitch. But David, one of the things that I love about Luton, and I'm not allowed to say this as a Borough fan because we're supposed to dislike them because they got promoted and we had a rivalry with them and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not into all that partisanship, you know, all the tribalism element, because you've got to appreciate when a club is built from the ground up. And I love the fact that Mick Harford has been at the heart of so much of what they've done as a football club. And the community is such an integral part of the vision and the culture and the feel around what the actual football club is supposed to be, and maybe even what football is supposed to be, even down to Kenilworth Road, you know, checking on someone's bathroom or what they're cooking for their tea while you're sort of walking into the football match. It's just got that sort of little mix of maybe how has this club got to the Premier League more than they're not a serious club, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I'll talk about that in just a second, just to round off what we said before and link it back to transformation. We talked about transformation at Postecoglou Spurs, McKenna's Ipswich, Savoyuk's Burnley. Part of that transformation, if you think about the Spurs one, is to give fans joy and hope, okay? And Dave alluded to football being a storied thing, which it very much is. So for me, Luton is a modern fairy tale about drama and possibility. Postecoglou said something in a conference this week he got from a podcast, and he said that he's going to bring joy through suffering. He said, because that's what being a fan is and what football is suffering, but every now and then you get a bit of joy. And this idea about Luton's transformation of coming up those leagues, but along the way, it's kind of solidified things. Like you said, they're bringing an ex-player who's still involved. I've worked in Luton, to give it a bit of context. I used to work at University of Luton. It's ethnically diverse, but sometimes it's a series of monocultures that don't mix. But the club has become a place where the cultures can mix and there can be a common thing and a project that people get involved in, whereby people from very different backgrounds can be shouting for the same team on the same terraces and looking in people's windows when they're going down because it's so embedded in the community. And there's something about an old ground, isn't there, and a ground that's so close to people. We talk about pitches where the crowd are close to the pitch, and there's something about a connection between the club and the people, that an intimate connection, if you like.
When you look at a club like Luton and you look at a club like Forest, I think you couldn't be sort of more opposite ends of the scale of what it is to get promoted to the Premier League. Forest spent, what was it, 165 million or something like that on 20 plus players and just about survived. Whereas Luton may not survive, but they've certainly secured the future of that football club by all the decisions that they've made in the previous maybe 5 to 10 years. Rob Edwards is another young coach who has had success for Forest Green Rovers. He's had success with Luton getting them promoted. I really hope that they stick by him, and I really hope that if it doesn't go how they want it to and they do get relegated, that he can be sort of the man to rejuvenate them and bring up. And similarly with Vincent Kompany as well. And even Paul Heckenbottom at Sheffield United. I think we need to get back into a position where if the manager fits the culture of the club and the club is moving forward, yeah, the manager's going to lose games. Because you know what? Your players aren't as good as everyone else. And sometimes that is just the way football works. Someone else had better players than you on that day. But if you can make that group, that community, that stadium bigger than sort of the sum of its parts, I think that's where you get that transformational effect long term, rather than maybe those big clubs who think, right, we've lost four in a row. If we lose five, that's it. It's like, but you've just played, you know, four of the top 10 in the league. Why would we do that? You know, you're saying about Luton's games they've got coming up. They may well get a couple of wins there. The performances improve. The fans get behind them. And it does create that extra bit of incentive behind them. Is there anything else? Any particular games? I know we've got the North London Derby coming up. Is there anyone in the Champions League that you're looking forward to watching, or in the Thursday night Europa games?
Well, I'm doing some work for Aberdeen on Thursday night, watching them play at Eintracht Frankfurt. And after the last couple of weeks losing 2-0 to Hibs and Arts, I have some trepidation. So,
two great names though in European football, isn't it?
Yeah,
for Aberdeen and Frankfurt.
For them to be back in the group stages is it's a terrific achievement. Yeah, and it's not an impossible group. I mean, I don't see them coming through it, but with HJK, Helsinki and Pauk, I mean, there's a possibility if they get some good results at Pitodri, they might sneak through. You never know.
And David, for yourself?
I'll take you to completely the other end. I'm coming back on week three of a hamstring rehab, and I'm hoping to get back to walking football at Saffron Walden on the 8th of October. And then my mate...
Which Gary channel Tindall, do we watch this on? Is this on...
Channel? Horror channel. and then my mate Gary Tindall from University of East London has bought us some VIP tickets for Charlton versus Bolton at the end of October, so I'll look forward to that. And to be honest, that's a nice link because last season, we do it every season, one game he treats me to for my birthday. And we watched McKenna's Ipswich last year, and that was a 4-4 draw. That was a really exciting game.
Brilliant. Dave and David, thank you very much for being part of the podcast. Really enjoyed that conversation. Lots of interesting details there about coaching, about culture, about the state of modern football maybe at the moment. So thank you both for joining me with that. If you've enjoyed the podcast, don't forget to share on your social media and give us a little like and a follow as well. We have been Today's Football Times, part of the These Football Times podcast network, and we will see you next week.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.